This is a CBC podcast. Take a trip back in time with CBC's Rewind podcast. Each week, Michael Enright presents a segment from our radio archives. Subscribe to the Rewind podcast at archives.cbc.ca.
Debunking the zeitgeist, debating the laptop, and dividing the balloons. Those are your keywords. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine. Hey, Search Engine. I have a story pitch for you. Not that you'll be allowed to do it. That's from one of many emails I've received from listeners daring me to report on the web phenomenon known as Zeitgeist the Movie. Now, if you're among the brainwashed conformist sheep who haven't yet seen Zeitgeist the Movie, well, let me run it down for you. Zeitgeist is a two-hour-long documentary of sorts uploaded to Google Video last summer. Over a relentless New Age drumbeat, a disembodied voice spins out the mother of all conspiracy theories.
Christianity, along with all other theistic belief systems, is the fraud of the age.
The arguments are illustrated with stock footage, movie clips, and cartoons. It's the kind of movie you could write, direct, and distribute without ever leaving your bedroom. Nevertheless, Zeitgeist is, like I said, a phenomenon. Constantly pumping into eyeballs around the globe through YouTube and Google Video and BitTorrent, it's estimated that it's being watched over 2 million times a week. And this week, on March 15th, will mark the first International Z-Day, when enlightened souls around the world unite and... well, I don't know, I guess they'll watch Zeitgeist the movie again. The film is uncredited, but someone calling himself Peter Joseph has published a website claiming authorship, which would make Peter Joseph among the most successful indie doc makers of all time, and all without so much as a whisper from the mainstream media. So, what shocking revelations that I will never be allowed to say on the air are contained in Zeitgeist the Movie? Okay, so apparently Christianity is a plagiarized remix of various Greek, Egyptian, and other pagan religions, cooked up by a shady group of elites so they could assert mind control over the masses and wage constant war for their own fun and profit, until one day the masses try to get free by founding America, but then the elites, who at that point somehow morph into a mysterious cabal of international bankers, show up there too and once again brainwash everyone, this time by rigging the Great Depression so they can scare the president into okaying a World Bank system that then funds Hitler, the assassination of JFK, the totally fake 9/11 attacks, and ultimately the creation of a one-world government where microchips will be implanted into everyone's arms.
That's right, microchipped.
Are we still on the air? Okay, so, yeah, I know. Boring. It's the same old paranoid jazz. But Zeitgeist the Movie weaves it all together really skillfully. And hypnotically, and with just enough truth mixed in to make you kind of wonder. Debating the finer points of the film's claims has become a popular pastime on the web, and we'll throw up some links on our website to point-by-point dissections, pro and con, if you've got the time for that sort of thing. Zeitgeist's own website has a sources page, which footnotes the film's quotations, some say rather poorly, and a clarifications page, which corrects minor errors like this one.
The First World War caused 323,000 American deaths. J.D. Rockefeller made $200 million off of it. That's about $1.9 trillion by today's standards.
It turns out he meant to say $1.9 billion. Oops. Hey, everybody makes mistakes. But what I found harder to excuse are the ways Zeitgeist deliberately misinforms its viewers. Like this quote. Cited as a response to the establishment of the U.S. Federal Reserve in 1913.
A world banking system was being set up here, a superstate controlled by international bankers, acting together to enslave the world for their own pleasure.
At the bottom of the screen, we are told that those words were spoken by the U.S. Congressman Charles McFadden. What we're not told is that McFadden was a Hitler-supporting nutjob who ran for president in 1936 under the slogan Christianity instead of Judaism. And that's the thing. Whereas the bad guys in Zeitgeist the movie are coyly referred to again and again as the international bankers, like-minded guys, such as Congressman Charles McFadden, just came out with it and blamed everything on the Jews. You see, there are no shocking revelations in Zeitgeist the movie. No great truths suppressed by the powers that be. And if we in the media tend not to give a voice to such nonsense, even when it's being seen 2 million times a week, well, that could be because we're under the thumb of a secret worldwide cabal of bankers more powerful than the president himself. Or it could be because Zeitgeist the movie is total bullshit. Last December, I interviewed Mary Lou Jepsen, a woman who designed the amazing screen of an amazing computer, the Exo $100 laptop. It's a device built by the nonprofit One Laptop Per Child Foundation, a group dedicated to empowering third-world kids with affordable tools that would give them a fighting chance in the global information economy. It was a feel-good story about a feel-good effort. But since we aired it, reports have been trickling in that something has gone bad at OLPC. First off, the $100 laptop, even as we reported it, was actually the $188 laptop. The affordability target had been missed by a wide margin. Then, in January, Intel, who had been supplying microchips for these laptops, pulled out of the project, citing philosophical differences with the group's mercurial leader, Nicholas Negroponte. Now, Negroponte shot back, saying that the real reason Intel pulled out was so that they could actively compete with the OLPC by marketing their own cheap laptop in developing nations. And then the third bomb dropped. Mary Lou Jepsen herself announced that she would be leaving the One Laptop Per Child organization to commercialize the display technology she invented there and to build, wait for it, the $75 laptop. When the New York Times broke this story, they were unable to reach Ms. Jepsen for comment. But we tracked her down for a second search engine interview, and Mary Lou Jepsen joins me now from Boston. Hello, Mary Lou.
Hello, Jesse.
Mary Lou, when we last spoke in October, the $100 laptop was something that everybody could feel good about. You, your boss, Nicholas Negroponte, your partners like Intel, and maybe most importantly, the developing nations and the kids in those developing nations. What happened?
I can't really comment. I left OLPC January 1st, and so I can't really represent OLPC anymore. That said, I'm still working with them, but in the form of a new company.
Can you tell me about your new company?
Sure. My new company is going to commercialize some of the technologies I invented and led the development of at OLPC.
Mary Lou, let me play you a clip from our interview last October.
Every laptop maker in the world, I think, has approached me about getting the screen in their laptop.
Yeah.
Cell phone makers, too. And I keep saying, well, you know, there's a billion children ahead of you in line, and we'll talk to you once
right.
we get them all outfitted.
You said you talked to them once the children were all outfitted, but you're talking to those companies now, and I'm pretty sure that the 1 billion needy kids are still, for the most part, not hooked up. So how did the companies get in line in front of ahead of the kids?
My job at OLP at One Laptop Per Child was largely done. I took this from an idea that Bill Gates and Craig Barrett laughed at and thought was a joke through the invention stage, the development stage, into high volume mass production. Now the problems facing OLPC are deployment, transformation of primary education in the developing world, and software upgrades. Unfortunately, as much as I'd like to be, and I really did try, I'm not an expert in those areas. The best way I can achieve that vision of one laptop per child, paradoxically, is by spinning out and commercializing some of the work, because that is the way to drive the cost lower.
Will you be directly competing with 100 laptop per child? You say that you're going to be developing a $75 laptop?
No, absolutely. absolutely not. One laptop per child is the beneficiary of this. They get whatever I produce at cost. So they just don't have to pay my salary or my travel budget or any of that.
I have to ask, the technology that you're now taking to the commercial market is technology that you developed with money that was donated to One Laptop Per Child for this good cause. Is it right for you now to go commercial with that technology?
OLPC is benefiting. The access to that IP is not by virtue of being an employee or the inventor, although I must say that the inventor of the technology has a pretty good chance of improving the price performance of her inventions. That's not the reason I got the access to the IP. The reason is that OLPC is the beneficiary of that license.
Mm-hmm. What's happened in a larger sense is it seems that Intel, having broken away from One Laptop Per Child, is being joined by a bunch of other companies, and they're all rushing to this market to make a commercial go of it in the third world and developing nations. And of that, Negroponte has said, well, we're like the World Food Program, and they're like McDonald's. And I'm wondering, what is your reaction to that?
I believe that the real market is in the developing world, and cost really does matter. If something costs 50-60% more than something else, there should be about a dozen so-called low-cost laptops on the market in the second half of 2008. The list price looks to be about $300, so more than 50% more expensive, shipping sort of last year's technology this year. You have to look and really think if it's worth it to spend that extra amount of money.
Let me ask you this. Would you license your technology to these companies that are directly competing with the XO laptop in the third world?
It's interesting because they may be competing with the XO laptop, and I need to talk to OLPC about that. And I certainly have no plans to do that at the moment. But it's hard to compete with the effort of One Laptop Per Child. The effort is One Laptop Per Child. I've seen Nicholas Negroponte stand on the stage countless times advocating that people buy other laptops, Dell laptops, Classmate, which is Intel's laptop, other laptop. OLPC's goal is very clear. OLPC stands for One Laptop Per Child.
And they don't care who, doesn't matter
sure,
who provides it.
The XO laptop is a product of it, and you could say that others compete with it, but we would like to make other people make better laptops for the developing world.
You know, one thing that One Laptop Per Child amid a lot of this controversy has been credited with is in opening the gates to the developing world, starting kind of a land rush on the idea of getting these people hooked up. And The Economist recently wrote that there are strong grounds to believe that supplying these laptops is best done for profit rather than out of charity or corporate social responsibility. Having gone, I guess, at least quasi-commercial with your technology, do you support that statement?
If One Laptop Per Child went for profit, I'd be very surprised if it could not be as successful.
Let me ask you one final question, Mary Lou. How many third world kids have gotten a laptop so far?
I think you're going to have to talk to OLPC on the latest numbers. Still get the daily allocation reports, but and some of the shipping details, but especially when there's a problem. But I'm not completely up to date on all of that.
Mary Lou Jepson, thank you very much for talking with me again.
Thank you. Bye bye.
We did call up the One Laptop Per Child organization to ask them how many computers they've actually shipped out. But they didn't get back to us in time for this broadcast, so we looked it up on Wikipedia, where we learned that they have fallen shy of their initial projection, which was to get 3 to 5 million computers out by the end of 2007. At this time, they've put into the hands of kids in developing and third world nations just over 500,000 laptops. Should colleges be copyright cops? That's exactly what was proposed in a recent piece of U.S. legislation. The College Opportunity and Affordability Act dealt mainly with federal college grants, loans, and scholarships. But tucked away in there was a provision dictating that if universities wanted federal cash for scholarships or anything else, they'd have to take responsibility for stopping online piracy and illegal downloads by students. Now, there was an uproar when this was first proposed, and it looked like the provision was going to be removed. But now it's come back into the bill in somewhat softer words. It's a story that's being followed very closely by Paul Jones, a professor of library science at the University of North Carolina, which is where we reached him. Hello, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Paul, when I was in university 8 years ago, the schools were the first place to get broadband internet access, and we were downloading music like nuts. I can only imagine that it's gotten much more rampant since then, no?
Well, actually, it's probably gotten less than then because home broadband has gotten much, much faster. Only 20% of college students in the U.S. actually live on the campus. The people are not file trading, coming to school on their laptops to quickly file trade.
So why do the studios then think that universities are such havens of piracy?
The study that's most thrown at us to support the attack on college students on campus as file traders said that 44% of the industry's losses for file trading were directly due to college students trading.
Right.
But last week, they announced that, oh, our numbers are wrong. Their new claim is 15% of the impact.
15% as opposed to 44%.
44. So we're talking about a 300% error.
Paul, I can certainly understand why the administrations of universities don't want the burden of policing their own student body for their downloading habits. But what I'm wondering is there a bigger reason why you, as a professor, as an educator, object to this bill?
Well, institutes of higher learning are about distribution of knowledge, legal distribution, and we work hard to make that happen. Peer-to-peer and programs like BitTorrent actually make it affordable and easy for that. For example, several of the torrents that are available for my bibliography are, ironically enough, the Congressional Record.
I see. So you're afraid that if the universities have to block peer-to-peer file sharing, then legitimate legal educational file sharing will be sacrificed in the process.
Killing every kind of information transfer because of the fear of a small economic impact caused by less than 3% of the population seems draconian.
Paul, where does Arnold Schwarzenegger figure into all of this?
Arnold did a number of movies, good and bad, in particular one called Junior.
Yes, of course, Junior. I think film buffs in our listenership will, of course, remember Junior as the cinematic gem in which Arnold Schwarzenegger becomes pregnant.
I really am pregnant.
Uh-oh.
My nipples are very sensitive.
An Ivan Reitman film.
Junior is a fairly generic term used to describe lots of things. One of the things it describes is a small Linux distribution that's very popular for people that want to put it on older computers. And we got a letter saying, we think you have our movie, Junior, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, our intellectual property, and we see it in your directories.
See, this is why I haven't seen it, because when I tried to illegally download that movie, I got some Linux program instead.
Well, there you are, and you were a better person for it.
That's a funny story, Paul, but it's not that surprising. The studios, lawyers threaten a lot of people. They threaten individuals and institutions alike. What is surprising to me is that now they're trying to actually change the law itself in the states so that these threats can actually be carried through. So how do you figure that they got this provision into an actual piece of legislation in the first place?
Frankly, it cost the MPAA not that much to lobby for this kind of thing. All the cost of actual implementation, which is fairly egregious, is placed on the universities. All the liability is placed on the universities, and all the penalty is placed on the universities. So it's a pretty good deal for them. I think everybody would like that for their business.
Paul, what's the worst case scenario here, in your opinion?
Well, the worst case scenario is that this legislation opens its way to further legislation tied to stopping innovative information sharing within campus and knowledge communities.
Professor Paul Jones, thank you for speaking with me today.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Picture a peaceful, prosperous, first world nation threatened to be torn apart by a political and linguistic separatist movement. Yes, I'm talking about Belgium, a country which, no joke, many people call the Canada of Europe. Now, on one side are the Dutch-speaking Flemings, who want more autonomy from the Francophone Walloons, who refuse to give it to them, suspecting that what the Flemings really want is to force separation. You still with me? Okay, now in the midst of this war of words between the Flemings and the Walloons, a new pro-unity national movement has been launched, thanks in large part to the web. Here's search engine contributor John Lawrenson in Brussels on how the internet may have saved Belgium.
Walk around Brussels these days and you'll be met by an extraordinary sight. The Belgians are putting out flags. Not the Walloon cockerel, not the Flemish lion, not the yellow stars of Europe, but the Belgian tricolour. These people I met were flying the black, gold and red.
Free from Belgium! Free from Belgium! Pretty, pretty Belgium! Pretty, pretty Belgium!
And if you can't hear us,
and if you can't hear us...
At school before, they said that we must be proud of Belgium, and why not?
There is a little bit of tension and you feel that, but it will be sad to see if Belgium will separate in two. Because then you have to make a choice where you live. Because I'm from Flanders, I will have to stay in Flanders, and it's difficult.
At the time we are talking about Europe, made of so many countries, it's useless and completely stupid and irrelevant to divide a small country with 10 million inhabitants like Belgium. Mm. We are back to the tribes from the ancient times.
And what would happen to Brussels, do you think, if they split?
It will die out, I'm afraid.
As well as the flags, there are posters all around this and other Belgian cities, again in the colours of the national flag, with the slogan, I want you for Belgium. It invites people to sign an online petition. I jot down the web address and go to find an internet connection. A new, simplified version of the Belgian national anthem with the words changed to I love you in French and Flemish greets you when you get onto the site. And the petition in favour of Belgian unity has been signed by 140,000 people. The online petition was started not by a politician, but a simple citizen, as she calls herself. Her name, Marie-Claire Houard. She lives in the Walloon city of Liège, or rather on the outskirts of Liège, in a street my taxi driver needs to pore over a map to find. So we turn up in front of a little brick post-war house with a Belgian flag hanging from the upstairs window, somehow both plucky and limp, appealing to the patriotic sentiment of the three people and a dog who walk up this street of an afternoon.
170
envelopes is today. Incredible.
Inside, on a front room table by a tank of tropical fish, Mrs. Houard tips out a box of papers. 170 more signatures for her petition in favour of Belgian unity that arrived in the post today. And that doesn't count people who signed online. It's all a bit overwhelming.
One day this August, early in the morning before going to work, I got on the computer and typed start a petition in the search engine. I thought it would be nice to have a little petition, something I could send around to my friends, maybe end up with a couple of thousand signatures at the end. It was a way of showing that I love my country, that the politicians should stop thinking of doing some things for the Flemings and other things for the Walloons, that instead they should work together for the whole of Belgium.
Opinion polls consistently show that most Belgian people don't want Belgium to split up. But until Mrs. Houard came along, they were a silent majority. Now they are present in the political arena and, it would seem, having an impact. Only a couple of weeks after Mrs. Houard handed in her petition, Belgium's politicians agreed to put their differences to one side for the time being and form the current interim government. There are those who point out that there are few Flemings in Mrs. Houard's camp, that she herself can't speak Dutch, the majority language of the people she claims to represent. And so her unity movement, in fact, shows how divided Belgium is. But at least she's given pro-Belgians a voice.
Waar wij hier leven.
Là où on vit.
back with that new version of the Belgian national anthem. They ask, in Flemish and French, is the place we live still a country? Yes, it's an un-country, a non-country, but it's the country that's my own.
Mais c'est le papi qui est le mien.
Belgium, the non-country. It's surely no coincidence that the most famous Belgian work of art is the Magritte painting of a pipe above the caption, "This is not a pipe." Belgium is full of people who don't believe Belgian people exist. Because, they'll tell you, there's not really a Belgian nation, no common language, hardly any army, a history that divides more than it unites. Belgium's often been invaded, but usually by armies on their way to invade somewhere else. Non-country, perhaps, but now, thanks to Marie-Claire Houard, a virtual country too. 40,000 people, a huge demonstration for Belgium, even marched in Brussels with Marie-Claire Houard at their head, her online virtual community of Belgian patriots made actual. However the Belgian crisis plays out, she has shown what a lady in Liège can do with a sense of nation, determination and an internet connection. For Search Engine, I'm John Lawrenson in Brussels.
Et voilà.
Et voilà.
Qu'est-ce que tu dis?
Va sécher?
Hein?
Hein, va sécher?
Quoi? Qu'est-ce qu'il a dit?
Search Engine is made through online collaboration. To get involved, visit our site, cbc.ca/searchengine, where you'll also find links and discussion on every story we've talked about today, plus our podcast. You can also find us on the Facebook group, Search Engine CBC, or by email at searchengine@cbc.ca. Search Engine is produced by Jeff Siskind, Andrew Parker, Stuart Einer, our online community, and me, Jesse Brown. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.